So we all knew it was just a matter of time. The Russians could not have discovered the soft underbelly of their chief adversary, the United States, as they did in 2016, without revisiting it again, and especially during an election year. And so we got the news today that the U.S. Department of Justice had announced an indictment of two members of Russia's RT network, so their national or sort of their international propaganda network, who were involved in a fairly complex scheme to funnel money to American influencers on social media, so on YouTube and Instagram and TikTok, to promote various narratives that are in line with the Kremlin's worldview, with an eye to influencing the politics on the ground in the U.S., particularly in an election year. So it was some of the themes were very anti-Ukraine, very cynical about Ukraine in relation to Russia. Lots of commentary about censorship. So any efforts at regulation of social media was censorship. These themes are found in the U.S., but they were being systematically promoted through this scheme. And so it was, they found that almost $10 million had been funneled through a company that was based in Tennessee that was producing this content at scale. So thousands of videos, amassing an audience of millions. And through some people in the YouTube sort of alternative media world that are fairly prominent. And you can look up their names if you'd like to see who it was. In addition to that, the U.S. had announced that they were seizing about just under three dozen website domains that were being used by the Russians to run websites that were basically faking the news, using the logos of real Western news organizations, but running false news stories through them that, of course, built up skepticism in certain areas, built up division and confusion in other areas. This was quite an announcement that was made during an election year, and it looked like it was time, I guess, for the U.S. authorities to unmask this campaign. My name is Chris Sapone, and on this topic, I'll be speaking with Matt Sussex from the Australian National University in Canberra.
So it's a very sophisticated operation with multiple parts and with the prospect of reaching a lot of Americans.
So it's interesting that this has come about, this setup has actually emerged in, I think, 2023, according to the indictment. So this is a recent sort of invention from RT. Is that correct?
Yeah, this looks like a kind of evolution of things that the Russian government was doing before, which were often state-sponsored troll farms. But this is deliberately reaching into the United States using American citizens to produce content that is favorable to the Russian government. And the indictment names not just a couple of Russian nationals who work at RT, that's Kostyantin Kalashnikov and Elena Afanasyeva, two Russia Today employees, but also Sergei Kirienko, who works very closely with Vladimir Putin in his presidential agency. So this is an allegation that Russian-sponsored disinformation goes all the way to the top at the Kremlin.
But it's interesting, too, that that in the indictment, and I've not seen commentary elsewhere to the contrary, but the RT employees appear to be RT employees. So not necessarily people from the intelligence world in Russia. These are people whose background is more around the world of creating content, marketing outreach, that sort of thing. So, I mean, it just shows how a seemingly privatized organization can do this sort of thing and move into the space and how it really is broadly. I mean, it is something where the tools and skills of the media are being used in a very strategic way to have this strategic effect.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, Chris. And, you know, we've known for a long time that Russia Today is effectively state media arm. But it's more than that. It's one that maintains that slight amount of plausible deniability, slight bit of distance from the Russian state by saying, well, you know, we are a private media organization. We have journalists and newsrooms, and we produce content just like any other in the West, like CNN and BBC and so forth. I mean, we do know that the Department of Justice has been particularly focused on its sort of chief of news, Margarita Simonyan, who is, you know, a very prominent figure when it comes to criticizing the West and when it comes to platforming the types of content on Russia Today that are all about, you know, fragmenting American society and fragmenting American opinion. So it's operating at this strange nexus between the state and between private enterprise that, you know, I think we find a lot of disinformation these days, given that it works best when it relies on proxies and it works best when it is viral in nature. And as this, you know, new indictment suggests, of course, it's only an allegation at the moment, but as this new indictment suggests, using American citizens to spread some of this content for Russia.
It's very interesting too, if you look at it in the U.S. political sphere. So the fact that this content can be so effective, it's building on ideas that are already there in a lot of cases, right? So isolationism, there's a long history of that in the US. This idea that the other side and the political realm is less legitimate. I mean, this is an idea that's been sort of cultivated for generations in the US, particularly, I mean, I think in terms of right-wing politics, where there's this slow sort of acid bath of cynicism that has been placed on the politics of the left over the years. This may be shifting, but for a long time, this is something that you would see in you know, organic right wing movement conservative material. So I think it's sort of a moment. It's a moment for reflection for people in the United States to consider the kind of politics that make it so susceptible to these sorts of influence campaigns, where somebody could just come over the top and say, look, we're just going to turn up the volume on this. We don't have to create new stuff, but just turn up the volume. And then it would have this paralyzing strategic effect on the foreign policy of the country. I think that's something that democracies and political parties and democracies have to look at.
It's absolutely fascinating, isn't it? It's, people who specialize in strategic studies will look at this as another manifestation of a sort of total war approach, where, you know, the aim is to win without fighting, where the aim is to, get your adversary to do things that are in your interests without them even realizing it. But, you know, viewed through the other, end of that telescope, it tells us something, I think, about not just the media landscape, but as you say, the political landscape in which the United States particularly, but, you know, other countries in the West as well haven't been immune to it, have done this drift towards not just tribalism, but also disengagement and mistrust of the state and mistrust of state institutions and mistrust of media. All those types of things are really fertile ground for hostile actors to weaponize, and frankly to amplify the types of divisions that are already existing in society, because that's the arena in which I think disinformation is most effective, where, you know, it tends to struggle seeding its own types of messages, but it does much better when it is boosting things that people feel emotionally and viscerally about. And I think you're absolutely right to say, well, now this is a bit of a message to both the left and the right, that politics has become exceedingly emotional and people become very invested in one side winning over the other at all costs. And that's actually not what democracy is supposed to be about. Democracy is supposed to be about respecting the outcome, regardless of whether you win or not. And I think that's something that we need to think about.
Yeah, no, it makes you ask the question, is the political rhetoric that we increasingly rely on, is it fit for the purpose of the challenge that democracy has in the 21st century. So, you know, you don't hear as much talk about loyal opposition. You hear this sort of, you know, this language that seems to be sort of zero sum, all against all, you know, political competition, where it's I win, you lose. And I think that, you know, that just creates such a playing field for adversaries outside of liberal democracies to really play, you know, to really lean into those divisions and create or exacerbate the strains within the system. So it is something that I do wonder if we're going to see a reevaluation, you know, the big picture of democracy, and for political parties, if they're going to have to start considering how they talk to each other, right? So that they can be sort of inoculated against the kind of division that is just so easy to gin up online and make worse through campaigns like these.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, we've been in an era for a while where you've had political parties wanting to not just dominate news cycles, but to also crush all opposition. And as you say, it's extremely adversarial. It's often not based on evidence and on reason. And it goes, it attempts to pluck at the heartstrings of people it's targeted at. But, you know, the end result of that is that it's not just polarizing, but it also infantilizes political debate. It turns everything into a three-word slogan. It tries to put everyone into a camp where they, they identify politically. And this is something that I think that is regrettable about the technological revolution, because, you know, it allows everybody to have a very loud voice. But at the same time, it also encourages, you know, mistrust and conspiracies. And fringe views when really the evidence doesn't point that way. And, you know, they say sometimes that a kindergarten teacher is the best front line against misinformation and disinformation, that this has to, you know, happen at an early age, and we have to learn again to be able to deploy reason and evidence. But, you know, it's going to have to be part of the long-term solution, I think, if we are going to be successful in being resilient against these kinds of attempts.
It's interesting to see even the response to this news in an hour by hour cycle. You can see that there are a lot of people who are very unhappy with these influencers, so these right-wing influencers in this case. And there's this real sense of, aha, you know, I've caught you. And I mean, if I was in Moscow looking at this, I think, well, this is the next wave of division. Now we just play up on the people that are saying aha to those who have found themselves caught up in these influence campaigns. So it's, you know, it shows that it's not, I mean, it's very post-ideological. Instead, it's very much about the mechanics of division, right, on networks. And some people have developed a bag of tricks, political technologists from Russia. They understand how to keep populations motivated and aggravated. And it's a matter of curation at a distance. And I think that that's what we're seeing here. And as you say, it's not with the troll farms. Now it's at this distance through intermediaries, but it's still quite effective and quite creative.
Oh, it's extremely effective. And you're right to say that, the landscape is one where it's win-win for a hostile foreign power that, okay, we've been rumbled, but now we'll just take off again because you'll have those who are outraged, and there are those who will double down and not want to believe it. Just reading through some of the comments on different news stories and on social media today, that there has been a really heavy, you know, pushback from individuals who think that this just is not a thing. It's just yet again, you know, the Biden Department of Justice trying to come after Trump and his supporters, and to vilify them and to tie them to, you know, shady Russian influence campaigns, and they just simply don't want to have a bar of it. I think those people really you're just not going to reach in society. There's we have to be realistic about how we go about building resilience against misinformation and disinformation. And, you know, that's part and parcel of democracy. If people want to believe something, then they can. that the challenge is, I think, to persuade, and the challenge is to persuade people that, well, you know, think again when you see things that make you emotionally invested, that make you outraged, because most of the time, a lot of the divisions we have in our society are the products of, relatively small differences. And as you say, it's post-ideological. But these are then turned into great big divisions and schisms within society. And certainly it's something where if you are a hostile foreign actor, you can just rely on your target to keep spreading it for you and keep the cycle going on and on and on until there's a conscious decision to try and break that cycle.
Yeah, I mean, it does, you know, it makes you wonder too about efforts at counter disinformation to date. A lot of them have relied on identifying the networks, appealing to the platforms to take them down, which is not always successful and is controversial in its own right, depending on who's on these networks. But then you wonder, given the role that creativity plays in how to go about doing this, right? If your job is to try to sow division in an open society where you have access to people in that society based on the nature of the open flow of information, you can take so many different approaches. So then it makes you wonder if the defense that we've seen in democracies to date, if it's right, or if they need to think a bit more holistically than tracking material down on the internet and looking for the other accounts that communicate with it. I mean, do you think that we're anywhere near where we need to be in this effort?
Oh, I don't think we're anywhere near where we need to be, and we're also not very good at countering disinformation. You know, whether it comes from formal government channels or whether it comes from civil society in democracies. The fact that you can utilize various different platforms with different messages targeted for different audiences and carefully curated for them, whether you're using TikTok or Insta or Twitter or YouTube, each of those users has a certain kind of, personality footprint, I suppose, where if you tailor the message the right way, you're going to get cut through. So it's more of a mindset than anything else, and a mindset shift that we have to encourage in order to build this sort of resilience. I remember being in Estonia at one of the big cyber conferences in, I think it was 2019, and someone made the very good point that for years and years, when we look at strategic threats in the West since 9/11, we focus very much on counterterrorism and counterinsurgency. And all that time, our adversaries were focusing on digital marketing and digital propaganda. And I think we have to come to terms with the fact that we're behind in the game on this, and that there will be attempts to produce this, what the Russians call reflexive control. Having a target population act exactly the way you want it to without noticing. And so it does have to be much more holistic than just simple fact-checking and saying this news story is fake news and, here are some Russia-sponsored bots and here's a Russian influence campaign. You have to have broad buy-in from society to say, okay, while we question the things that we read and while it's normal and natural to question the things that we read, we're going to have a higher bar for evidence and a higher bar for what we believe to be true.
You wonder too, this, if it's a matter of the information. So it's not just counter disinformation or trying to block it, but it's this evolution of us with our information environment. So it would be like information ecology, right? So what is this environment that we're in? It's how different is it than what the systems in our institutions were built on? I mean, I think that's part of it as well. So that now, so come 2024, the concept that Russia may be interfering in this way is not new, right? So it's been around. It hit with a big shock in 2016, obviously, it's subject to the dark shining moment. But now this is sort of an established understanding that this is always the risk that we have in our open information environment. But then the question is just how is society going to, evolve those defenses that are natural? And I do think that, I mean, you talk about a kindergarten teacher, and I know that initially after 2016, there was lots of talk of the need for better education, but there is an element, I think, generational to it, which is that if you grow up in this completely networked environment, these things aren't so hard to believe. I think part of the shock in earlier times was that we did think that geography protected us. And I know we've had this conversation before, but our geography in a networked world just doesn't protect us like it used to.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, to an extent, Chris, it's you and me are being sort of old guys looking at this phenomenon. If you want to understand it, I think one of the best people to do, best categories of person to talk to are teenagers, who are actually quite adept at spotting fake stuff, because they engage with it all the time. The trouble is, in fact, it's often older people who have preconceived ideas about what they should trust and what they should believe, who will fall for propaganda, that will fall for digital mis and disinformation. So, you know, it's a challenge that goes across society and across the state, but it's a challenge also that you know, has pockets of, you know, quite robust strength and resilience within it. And I think it's, you know, there's a lot to be gained from finding out where those pockets of strength and resilience are, and learning lessons about that type of ecology in which we live, where multiple platforms will be used for multiple different nefarious purposes, you know, just become better at spotting this stuff. Because the way it's being peddled at the moment, particularly with, you know, this Russian effort, which is, you know, has added up to over 16 million views of 2,000 videos produced by a company out of Tennessee. You know, that's reaching a lot of Americans, and not just Americans who already believe, you know, the line that's sympathetic to Russian interests, but those potentially who could be voters. So this is something that touches on electoral politics just as much as it does social cohesion.
And in the geopolitics, I mean, this is something that for Russia, it makes sense for them to, they can either fight Ukrainians on the ground in Ukraine and now in Russia, or they can try to change or sway the opinions of people in the United States who would, if they can sway them enough, oppose U.S. and Western support for Ukraine. I mean, that's part of this great game that we're seeing right now.
Oh, totally. It's and you know, either persuade Americans to reject aid for Ukraine, or just make them apathetic enough that they don't care. When you know, you have those in the Congress and in the Senate who will aggressively push bills to block Ukraine funding. Apathy for the propagandist is pretty much as good as political polarization, and in terms of how it might impact on geostrategy and geopolitics.
Matt, thank you very much.
Chris, it's always great talking to you.